valuable artifacts and religious books and manuscripts were incinerated. Cultural cleansing meant to weaken the soul of the Iraqi people. My dad's success with this Nestorian puzzle led him to other remarkable discoveries. He stumbled onto the haunting story of Dr. Paul Shikwana, the public health pioneer who came to the United States at the turn of the last century and mysteriously died outside Iowa City. Next, he became fascinated with the life story of a relative on my mom's side, my great-uncle, Nuri Rafael Kotani, who was a revolutionary in the 1930s. Haji told my dad about his first cousin, Nuri, and how much he had admired him as a boy in Baghdad. Nuri was a bit older than Haji, and after attending American University in Beirut from 1928 to 1930, he studied railway engineering at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He became politically active there in the ferment of the Great Depression and neglected his studies, lost his scholarship, and was kicked out of school. He returned to Iraq afterward, which he found bleak after his time in Cambridge, and continued his radical organizing. Nuri's nom de guerre, a useful device to thwart the secret police, was Enwar. He spoke four languages and was plugged into international liberation causes, including activism against the British mandate in Palestine. In Iraq, in 1935, he founded a leftist organization with a really kick-ass name, the Association Against Imperialism and Fascism. Nuri signed its manifesto, which called for independence from colonialism, and it became the starting point for the Iraqi independence movement. For an Iraqi, this is a little like an American having a relative who signed the Declaration of Independence. But Nuri's activism came with a price. He was a target of the Iraqi monarchy, which imprisoned, tortured, and killed many of his comrades. Sought by the king's secret police, he lost his job and was forced to go into deep hiding for months. Nuri hid in a spare room of Haji's family home for many weeks until a safer location could be found. Then Haji's mother dressed him in a woman's abaya and transported him to safety. He fled to Paris in 1937 and became involved in pre-war activism that led to the French Resistance. Then he moved on, joining 35,000 other freedom-loving idealists in the international brigades that were fighting the fascists in Catalonia on behalf of the Spanish Republic. He served with American volunteers in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, was promoted to officer, and fought in the pivotal Battle of the Ebro, often called the First Battle of the Second World War. Nuri was one of only two Iraqis in the international brigades. The other was his friend, an Iraqi Jew, named Seti Abraham Haresh. What I love most about his story is Nuri's bravery, persistence, and unfailing loyalty to a borderless progressive cause. He fought for something bigger than a country or a religion, a tribe or an ethnic group. He fought for all people, for humanity, with a hope that there was another way to live. As a young woman, when I heard the stories that Haji told about Nuri, I couldn't help but imagine my great uncle fighting with Spanish Republicans. And I thought of him hanging out with Ernest Hemingway, George Orwell, Langston Hughes, and other idealists from far and wide who came together for this quintessentially romantic progressive fight of the 20th century. But alas, the defense of the Spanish Republic was a losing battle. With Hitler's help, fascist dictator Francisco Franco took control of Spain in 1939. It sure didn't help the cause of freedom that General Motors and other U.S. auto companies sent 12,000 trucks to help Franco, basically on credit. Even so, Nuri continued to fight fascism and imperialism. We know that because, in a wild coincidence, my father's father, Dawood Hanna, the railroad station manager, had a memorable meeting with him in 1956. Along with thousands of leftists and political descendants, Nuri was rounded up on the order of the King of Iraq and sent by train to a prison fortress in the remote desert of Samawa. The trains were known as Qatar al-Mot, or Trains of Death, because most of the political prisoners did not survive. But my grandfather, Dawood, who sympathized with the activists, happened to be in charge of the Samawa station. When he heard that Nuri Rafael Kotani, a well-known resistance fighter, was arriving on the train and was bound for prison, my grandfather found him and quietly offered him water and words of comfort. It was a risky thing to do. My dad, a young boy at the time, recalls being scared that his father would be caught. Luckily, he wasn't. And luckily, Nuri survived imprisonment and was freed 2 years later, around the time of the Iraqi Revolution, and was appointed the railway minister in the Qasim regime. But not for long. A counter-revolution rose up in 1963, and imprisoning leftists was in vogue again. Thousands more were sent off to Samawa. By the time Nuri died in 1980, he had spent half of his life in hiding or in jail. My dad's childhood was shadowed by the decline of his homeland. As a boy, he had been a first-hand witness to the abduction and gruesome death of Iraq's prime minister, Nuri al-Sa'id, as he fled through the Baghdad streets on the day after the July 14, 1958 revolution to overthrow King Faisal II. A brief window of peace and prosperity for Iraq followed, and to some degree, this is the Iraq that both my parents remember fondly. A moment in their youth when their country was open, progressive, and diverse. People weren't persecuted for their religion or politics. Women dressed as they pleased. Photographs from my mom's college years in the 1960s, when she studied chemistry, look like images from UC Berkeley. She wore fashionable short skirts and held liberal values. But unlike France, where the 18th century reign of terror, its counter-revolution, had lasted only a few years, Iraq's terror, the Ba'athist years, lasted decades. Some of the very best people of Iraq were imprisoned and killed. Writers and poets, scientists, free thinkers, intellectuals, academics, teachers, and political organizers. The mass murder and purging of communists throughout the Cold War in the Middle East uprooted the left wing, stifled secular voices, and led to the brain drain that was one of many causes of fundamentalism. The people who were dismissed and ignored, imprisoned and killed, or who'd fled, could have made Iraq a great country, both rich and diverse. But now, after decades of tumult, war, sanctions, occupation, and civil war, their lives and work, and the ideals they fought for, are all but forgotten. As for my dad, he had never planned to leave Iraq. But things conspired to change his mind. First, his father was arrested during the first Ba'ath Revolution, along with tens of thousands who were suspected of political opposition. Dawood was imprisoned near Basra. Worried that the police would come looking for evidence of his political views, my grandmother, Mama Evelyn, gathered all his books with red covers, wrapped them with a blanket, and buried them in their yard. Dawood was released from prison a couple of months later and returned home, but was never completely whole again. This pushed my dad to make something of himself. He worked hard in high school, but the slots for Christian students in Iraqi universities were limited. So he applied for a scholarship to study in Yugoslavia and was accepted. At 16, he traveled alone from Baghdad to Zagreb by train, almost 2,000 miles, to attend a language boot camp to learn Serbo-Croatian. He went on to the University of Zagreb to study mechanical engineering using old-school German methods, learning to draft perfect letters, and becoming a master of the slide rule. On a trip home to Baghdad, he met my mom, and they stayed in Baghdad long enough to marry and have my brother. Then they moved to Sheffield, my birthplace, a steel town in England that Margaret Thatcher's union-busting policies had destroyed, much like Flint, so my dad could finish his studies. The plan was to go back home to Baghdad after that, but returning to Iraq would have meant working at a government job he'd been assigned, at the Azeraq nuclear power plant, and possibly dying there. It was bombed by Israel in 1981. Instead, they moved to Houghton for my dad's postdoc work, then on to Royal Oak, when he got the job with GM. Meanwhile, the homeland my father knew and loved was quickly disappearing behind him. Almost nothing was written about Saddam Hussein in the U.S. media in the 1980s. Saddam was considered a friend of the Reagan administration, even though his brutalities and murders were well known abroad. During the Iran-Iraq War, 1980 to 1988, the United States actively supported Saddam with intelligence and food credits, and also allowed Iraq to buy high-tech equipment for chemical weapons. The truth is, oil made Iraq a prosperous ally in the Middle East, and Saddam's anti-communist zeal blinded Europe and the United States to his true nature. This outraged my dad and fed the fire in him. He never gave up trying to right the wrongs and spread the word of the horrors of the Ba'athist regime. Connecting with a community of dissidents, he increasingly spoke out against Saddam and the Ba'athists. Even though my mom worried that his actions could hurt family members still in Baghdad, including her brother, who was conscripted to fight in the Iran-Iraq War. Saddam had spies and agents in the United States, people who could hurt us, but that never stopped my dad either. My dad published opposition newsletters and newspapers, which he sent to other Iraqis abroad and to U.S. government leaders, politicians, and other activists. He laid out the articles and photographs by hand in his office at home. And this is where I always picture him in my mind when I think back on those years, holed up in his office with a cigarette in hand, listening to the crackling shortwave radio, desperately reading the Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch reports that came in the mail, hoping to keep up with the latest news of Iraq. And it was always bad news, always depressing, troubling, even traumatizing. I was 11 or 12 when he showed me photos from the genocide of Halabja in southern Kurdistan. I stared at the shocking images, and he explained. The Kurdish resistance, with their brave Peshmerga soldiers, both men and women, had been fighting Saddam for years. It wasn't enough that the downtrodden and persecuted Kurds were bombed with napalm and rockets. Saddam ramped up his attack to chemical weapons. 7 or 8 Iraqi warplanes dropped bombs of poison on residential areas of Halabja. Later, eyewitnesses gave accounts of clouds of white and yellow rising, twisting upward, and columns of smoke in the sky. The chemicals were a mix of things, different toxic gases that killed some people immediately. Others were burned and died slowly and painfully. As many as 5,000 civilians were killed, and another 7 to 10,000 were horribly injured. The genocidal massacre is the largest chemical weapons attack directed against a civilian population in history. An entire city was poisoned. That was the first time I saw a dead child, an infant wrapped in a pink blanket being held by her father. They had died in each other's arms. I have never forgotten it or gotten over it, and I never will. Mark and I grew up quickly that way. We understood that leaders could be dangerous, that civilization sat on the delicate edge of a precipice, and that injustice must be challenged. We were taught not to look away. That made it hard, in the ensuing years, to watch the continuing losses, the pain and suffering. Baghdad, once the pride of the Arab world, once modern, prosperous, and on the verge of freedom, quickly became a lost city in a broken country, adrift from its past. Nightmares of Halabja persisted throughout my childhood, the trauma of the images I saw still searing and strong, but eventually this atrocity was dwarfed by our two wars in Iraq and the sanctions in between, the wars we saw on CNN. The sanctions were a quieter but more deadly affair. They hurt innocent people and never touched the heart of Saddam's operations. Overall, the 1990s were a time of pointless misery, when tens or even hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children may have died. It left me wondering, throughout my teenage years and young adulthood, if the leaders of my adopted home cared about kids at all. We knew how lucky we were. and we knew how bad things could be. Challenging injustice means standing up for the weak, the vulnerable, the abused, and the forgotten, be it in health, employment, education, or the environment. It means being vigilant on behalf of people who are treated as pariahs and scapegoats, populations that are dehumanized, displaced, and treated as disposable. It means fighting oppression at every opportunity, no matter the place or country. Mark and I have reacted to our childhoods by involving ourselves in making things better. Elliot and I haven't raised Nina and Layla in exactly the same way. We aren't showing them pictures of murdered children, but try instead to encourage empathy and service and a sense of belonging and identity. We tell them family stories so they know where they came from, so they know there are strong people behind them, ones who overcame struggles, even persecution, and made sacrifices to fight the good fight. Chapter 17, Meeting the Mayor. Monday, September 21st. A simple plan. To meet the mayor at 1 p.m., show him my study results, reveal the proof of elevated blood lead levels, and have him issue a health advisory that would finally alert the residents of Flint to stop drinking the water. I had high expectations for how it would go, and not just because I'm an eternal optimist. First, I was presenting numbers. It's hard to argue with numbers. Second, our mayor, Dane Walling, was born in Flint, still lived in Flint, and was raising two kids in Flint. I felt no matter what the political calculations were, he had a personal and intimate stake in Flint's drinking water. On top of that, I knew Walling was a smart guy with larger ambitions. He had served as mayor for 6 years, and while he was popular, the next election was only 6 weeks away. The seriousness of this sort of public health crisis on his watch and its political implications wouldn't be lost on him. This was a chance for him to take the water issue head on and own it. Yes, Walling was the same mayor who had supported the switch to the Flint River and had even gone on TV to publicize it, smiling while he drank the water. But if he had made a mistake or been misled by the EPA and MDEQ, I hoped he would be big enough to admit it and try to get ahead of a potential scandal by coming out in favor of a real solution. As a Democrat, he wasn't enthralled to or in the inner circle of the Republican governor, Rick Snyder, whose administration's take-no-prisoners budget cuts were behind the water switch. From what I could see, Walling was free to reach his own conclusions and confront the state with me. The governor may have usurped his power, but he was still an important voice in the city and had the moral and leadership power of the office to represent the people of Flint and do what he was supposed to do, serve the public. Also, he was a lifelong friend of Senator Jim Ananick. They had grown up in Flint together, and Kirk Smith had only good things to say about him. I kept replaying all these positive factors in my mind, all so real and clear to me, to buoy my hope. I wasn't just hoping for the best, I expected it. But that didn't mean I wasn't nervous. A lot was riding on me now. Kirk, Senator Ananick, and Dr. Reynolds all believed in me, and they hadn't even seen the data yet. My research and numbers had to be perfect, and so did my presentation. I wasn't a politician, government official, or trained speaker, but I wasn't afraid of the spotlight either. The days and nights I had spent in drama club back at Kimball High School were paying off. Part of any performance is selecting the right costume. My clothing choices were limited to the things in my closet that still fit me, but I wanted to wear a suit and found one. I had purchased it years before, back when I was a medical student and doing residency interviews. Otherwise, I rarely wore it or needed it. The reason is simple. Whatever outfit I'm wearing is usually covered by my white coat. It's the only thing anybody sees or remembers about me. But I rarely wore the white coat outside a medical setting. And our meeting with Mayor Walling was to be downtown, in the Mott Foundation building on Saginaw Street, where the Greater Flint Health Coalition had its offices. The conference room at the Health Coalition seemed cavernous, as if it were waiting for twice as many people. About a dozen of us spread ourselves around the long oval table, and I sat down at the head, so I would be next to the screen for my presentation. Dane Walling arrived with a perfect smile. He sat down next to me, greeted me in a warm and friendly way, and said he remembered my brother from college. Like any accomplished politician, he was great at eye contact and gave off a sense of decency, confidence, and acute interest in what he was about to learn. That same sense of openness, or even eye contact, was not happening directly across the table. Where Natasha Henderson, the Flint city manager, and Howard Croft, the public works department head, were sitting. Without a word, they made known their feelings about the meeting immediately. Henderson, an uber-professional woman, had been city manager for a couple of years already. Due to recent events and the stepping down of the Flint EM, she arguably had more power than Mayor Walling, certainly more de jure power. She answered to nobody but the governor's office. She was wearing her hair down, perfectly styled, in an elegant suit. She was confident and chilly when she entered the conference room, with a very unenthusiastic greeting, then didn't look at me or smile for the next 90 minutes. Croft seemed to care even less. His sleepiness and audible yawns communicated a total lack of interest in the meeting, if not downright disapproval. I was feeling anxious until Dr. Reynolds sat down to my right. His presence helped calm my rattled nerves. My resident Allison, who had just started my community pediatrics rotation, was on the other side of the mayor, sitting a little stiffly and uncomfortably between him and Senator Ananick, who was flanked by his chief of staff, Andy Levitt. I gave Allison a warm and protective smile. I could tell she was nervous too, and would probably rather be working in the intensive care unit. Kirk was on the other side of them, which was great, because I could catch his eye and see his expression. A few physicians were scattered in other seats, including no-nonsense Pete Levine, the executive director of the Genesee County Medical Society. Jenny was at the far end of the table, directly across from me. Good old Jenny. It felt like she and I had gone over our numbers a million times. She came as my data backup, if I needed one. Before I'd arrived, Kirk had texted to tell me some stunning news. He'd held a board meeting for his health coalition earlier that morning, during which he announced that new data showed elevated levels of lead in Flint water. He had insisted that the community be informed. His health coalition board included Mark Valachek, the county health officer, who pushed back immediately when the Flint water was questioned. Valachek claimed it was in alignment with the Safe Drinking Water Act, and besides, no health advisory could be issued without a directive from MDEQ. When Kirk asked his board to vote on a resolution urging a health advisory, Valachek stayed silent, abstaining from casting a vote. The resolution passed without him. The meeting with the mayor got underway after some awkward introductions, which included patching in Dean Dean on the speakerphone of his car. I began my formal presentation with an explanation that under normal circumstances, this kind of data would not be offered publicly until it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. But that usually took months, and we didn't have months. The information was too urgent to sit on. With the laptop open before me and the screen behind me, I stood while the PowerPoint slides were projected onto the screen. The first slide showed words in large boldface type, in red. Pediatric lead exposure in Flint, Michigan. A failure of primary prevention. My presentation was mostly science, data, and data analysis. So I started it with something human and real. A photograph of a little girl who looked just like Reva, one of our Hurley patients when she was 1 year old. I described her as a baby who lived in Flint. To protect my patient's privacy, she was a composite of several kids I knew. I named her Michaela, not an uncommon name in Flint. Michaela lives with a single mom and two older siblings on the west side of the city. Every morning her mom wakes up and makes a warm bottle of formula for her. The powdered formula comes from WIC, and it's mixed with warm tap water. Babies like warm bottles. She has just come into the Hurley Clinic for her one-year checkup. She is smiling, looks great, and seems robust. Her physical exam and development appeared to be normal. She received her one-year-old vaccines and routine lead and hemoglobin screening. A couple of days later, her lead level comes back as 6 micrograms per deciliter. It's elevated. There is no safe level, but 5 micrograms per deciliter is the current reference level set by the CDC. My next slide showed a quote from a 2012 report of the CDC Advisory Committee on Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention. Because no measurable level of blood lead is known to be without deleterious effects, and because once engendered, the effects appear to be irreversible in the absence of any other interventions, public health, environmental, and housing policies should encourage prevention of all exposure to lead. I looked up at the faces around the oval table. Everybody was staring at the slides and listening intently. Even Howard Croft and Natasha Henderson were paying attention, although they had both perfected a look of politely enduring a pointless exercise. The mayor was writing in a notebook. "What will happen to Michaela?" I asked. I didn't inflate or exaggerate the answer. Even a conservative estimate was scary enough. And just looking at the information on the screen made me angry. But I stayed pleasant and tried to channel my passion and rage into just being as forceful as I could. The vast evidence supports an increased likelihood of a decrease in IQ. Even a blood level of 1 to 4 micrograms per deciliter, which is not yet considered above the reference level, drops the mean IQ by 3.7 points. This reduces the number of high achievers, or those with an IQ over 130, and increases the number with low IQ at 70, shifting that bell-shaped curve to the left. This impacts not only life achievement expectations, but special education services and employment prospects. This has drastic implications at the population level. Elevated lead levels in childhood also increase the likelihood of ADHD behaviors, juvenile delinquency, and rates of arrests involving violent crimes. In terms of health, it impacts almost all systems of the body, the hematologic, cardiovascular, immunologic, and endocrine. The mood in the room shifted from intense interest to concern, even despair. Senator Ananick shook his head in disbelief. He was probably thinking about the foster baby at their home in Flint that he and his wife had fallen in love with and were now hoping to adopt. Next to the state senator, Andy, his chief of staff, was grimacing and huffing in frustration. His cheeks were turning redder and redder. Kirk also looked shaken. Dr. Reynolds was nodding in approval. He knew about the long-term effects of lead. He was an expert. I couldn't see Mayor Walling's face. He had stopped me twice for some clarifications, but now he was looking down at the table, perhaps morosely, maybe penitently, and still calmly taking notes. Then I got to the costs, because this was what the city, the county, the state, and the federal government would pay attention to. People listened to dollar signs. Wasn't that how we got into this mess? You had to factor the number of children who had been exposed and make a forecast of costs. It was about probabilities and estimates, but that is how governments plan ahead and prepare. When there's a hurricane, the estimates of economic cost begin almost instantly. When there's a viral outbreak, the CDC and FEMA don't just make survival plans and prevention strategies. They immediately begin determining what it's going to cost to implement them. I quoted from the latest figures I could find. Based on a 2011 Health Affairs report, Reducing the Staggering Costs of Environmental Disease in Children, which estimated that in 2008 alone, $76.6 billion was spent on environmental diseases. For childhood lead poisoning, it was $50.9 billion in lost economic productivity resulting from reduced cognitive potential. Looking at costs to the state, I cited a report, The Price of Pollution, published by the Michigan Network for Children's Environmental Health. Based on a 2009 study of a group of 5-year-olds with household lead exposure, paint and paint dust, not water, because nobody had studied that yet. It showed economic losses attributable to lead exposure ranging from $3.19 billion to $4.85 billion per year in future lifetime earnings. Now I got to the heart of the matter, water. I cited research showing that when lead was in drinking water, the greatest impact was on pregnant mothers and developmentally vulnerable formula-fed infants. For about 25% of infants drinking formula made from tap water at 10 parts per billion, or ppb, blood lead would rise over the CDC level of concern of 5 micrograms per deciliter. Increase in fetal death and reduced birth weights. I brought it all home to the water in Flint. I referred to the work of Mark Edwards and his results from testing the Flint water. His team had provided 300 water testing kits to residents in specific wards or districts. Citizen participation had been incredible. A record number of those kits, 252 or 84%, had been mailed back to the Virginia Tech lab in Blacksburg. Then I went into my research. I described the methodology and approach, how we had used data processed at Hurley Medical Center, received IRB approval for our research, and zeroed in on blood lead levels of all children 5 years of age and younger in 7 Flint zip codes. 2 periods of study were compared, pre-switch blood lead levels from January 1st to September 15th, 2013, and post-switch levels during the same months of 2015. The sample used was 1,746 Flint children, pre- and post-switch. Post-switch, the percentage of children with blood lead elevation was almost double. I emphasized that this increase was contrary to every national and state trend. Elsewhere, the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels had been coming down every year. Then I looked closely at water lead levels in each zip code, based on Mark Edwards' work, to prove a causal relationship. The zip codes with the highest water lead levels saw the greatest increases in the percentage of children with elevated blood lead levels. To show the dramatic contrast between Flint water pre- and post-switch, Jenny and I had created a few more graphs showing comparisons. Senator Ananick rocked forward in his seat, taking an audible deep breath. He was stunned. He leaned over to speak to Kirk and seemed distressed. His eyes were brimming with tears. Dr. Reynolds was nodding, his mouth tight, as if fire would come out if he opened it. The mayor looked concerned and was nodding too. Henderson was still going with her stony-faced thing, but for a second, Howard Croft seemed to be caving. Or maybe he was falling asleep. I couldn't tell. I went on. The next slide compared Flint to the rest of Genesee County, where the water was the same as ever. This comparison made it clear that there was no statistically significant increase in elevated blood lead levels in the rest of Genesee County, only in Flint. Next, I really wanted to bring home that my blood lead results, although striking, underestimated the potential exposure. Medicaid mandated lead screenings at a child's 1- and 2-year checkups, but that was way too late if you were worried about lead in water. Infants are not screened for lead exposure, I said, and lead has a short window of detection in blood, a half-life of 28 days. Also, many children who are supposed to be screened never are. I reiterated the concept of primary prevention, our most basic obligation to keep children away from sources of harm. The moment when a child's medical doctor learns of an exposure to this powerful toxin, it is too late. We grossly failed at primary prevention. The next slide described next steps. Encourage breastfeeding. No tap water for high-risk groups such as infants on formula and pregnant mothers. Declare a health advisory. Distribution of lead-clearing NSF-approved water filters. Public education regarding precautions. Reconnect to Lake Huron Water Source ASAP. I ended my presentation with a photograph of a little girl I called Michaela. I figured if I didn't get them with the data, facts, and numbers, I could get them with emotion. Michaela looked at the camera with such trust and innocence. "She seems great now," I said. "She's smiling and looks perfectly healthy. But what will her future hold?" "Leaving absolutely nothing on the table," I said. "And what does it hold for an entire generation of Flint children?" As soon as I finished, the mayor asked a few questions. He was polite and not defensive at all. He wanted clarification about a few things and seemed appropriately concerned. "I hope this is part of an awakening," he said, "that Flint does have a lead problem, something I've been concerned about for years." He continued on this note for a minute or two. Flint had even gotten an award for excellence in lead remediation, an achievement for which he felt responsible, and he was proud of it. But he was talking about lead paint and lead in the environment. He never actually said the word water. He referred to a public statement he had made just a week before, that Flint would be lead-free by 2016. "Huh?" Now, having seen my presentation, he seemed excited that finally, finally, the rest of us were jumping on the lead awareness bandwagon he'd been driving for years. I was confused. Andy looked noticeably disturbed. He leaned over to Jim and spoke in his ear, what I was sure was a choice profanity. They both shook their heads. Dr. Reynolds jumped in to affirm the seriousness of the problem. "That beautiful man is quite a talker, an epic rambler who goes on and on. That's his style, and it works." The room was captivated. He spoke of a crisis. He said it was an emergency. I was a young pediatrician no one had heard of, but Dr. Reynolds was a famous face and name in the city. While he spoke, I looked discreetly around the table again, to see if this powerful soliloquy was shaking up the city officials. It also mattered that Dr. Reynolds is African-American and lives in Flint, the eighth largest majority-minority city in the United States, 57% black, 37% white, and 6% other, mostly Latino. The installment of the EM, even a black one, rather than an elected official to represent Flint, had been the last straw. Black Flint residents knew how the city had lured their great-grandparents and grandparents with promises of industry jobs and prosperity, and that they had often had to accept lowly jobs, crappy housing, and segregated neighborhoods while their white counterparts were offered management positions, home mortgages, and eventually the chance to flee Flint for a nice all-white suburb just outside the city limits. And then there was me. Somewhere in the middle, I wasn't black, and I wasn't white either. I felt, as I often do, like an outsider, straddling but never completely or comfortably inside either world. My professional life now felt the same way, straddling. I work in Flint, and all my patients live here, and so do many of my pediatric residents, but I don't live in Flint myself, so I worried that I wasn't an entirely credible Flint voice. But Dr. Reynolds was. He exuded wisdom and credibility. And as pediatricians, we both had a professional obligation to speak up for kids. After Dr. Reynolds finished, Kirk described the resolution that his board had passed that morning calling for a health advisory. The mayor was finally ready to talk water. "We've just this morning had a meeting about this with the EPA and DEQ," he said. "And they've told us there's no corrosion issue. It has to do with old pipes in residents' homes and couldn't be helped." Something inside me wilted. He was copping out already. Okay, maybe there is lead in the water, he was saying. But it isn't the city's, the state's, or the feds' responsibility, or mine. It's the people's fault. I couldn't help but think how this echoed the lead industry's blaming of victims. Then he mentioned the prohibitive cost of switching back to Detroit water. Flint just couldn't afford that. Besides, he said, isn't everybody in Flint already flushing their water? I pressed my lips tight together to make sure I didn't inadvertently blurt out an expletive or scream. Without visibly turning my head, I caught the eyes of Kirk, then Jenny. Jenny's mouth was agape. I could see they were as disturbed as I was. Flushing? I was a pediatrician with an environmental health background, and even I didn't know to flush water after prolonged periods of non-use. And did anyone think Flint residents, who were paying the highest water rates in the country, were going to waste water for 5 long minutes of flushing? Howard Croft went next, attempting to back up the mayor. His job and reputation were on the line, and that was all I was hearing, or thought I was hearing. He was like Gonzo the Muppet. He opened his mouth, and no point came out. I spoke up again. This is a crisis. This is an emergency. I talked about needing bottled water for the infants in the city, or pre-mixed formula, and the water had to be switched back immediately. That's impossible. Henderson had been sitting at the table for almost an hour and hadn't said a word, but now she finally spoke up with unshakable certainty. She made it clear that there was absolutely no money for Flint to switch back to Detroit water. The pipeline to Detroit has already been sold. She shot me a disapproving, "Why are you wasting my time with this crap?" look. She reiterated the information that she and the mayor had received on their conference call with MDEQ and the EPA that morning. She believed what they had told her, and she was sticking to that. "They say there are no corrosion issues," she said. "The water tested fine at the source." "The source isn't the problem," I interrupted, then began to describe why testing at the source was irrelevant. "I had taken a crash course in water treatment only in the last couple of weeks," I explained, "but I had consulted a former EPA water treatment scientist, Elon, and I had met with Mark Edwards." The second I said Mark's name, I felt a blast of Arctic air from Henderson and Croft. Once everyone else at the meeting had a chance to weigh in, including Dean Dean from the speakerphone, expressing gratitude for my study and the presentation, I gave the mayor an ultimatum, delivered as kindly and benignly as possible. It was pretty simple. If he wouldn't stand with me and make the announcement that there was lead in the blood of the kids of Flint, then we would do it without him. Kirk, Melanie, Senator Ananick, Andy, and I had agreed on this step going into the meeting. Andy had been adamant about issuing a deadline for the mayor, and he wanted it to be Wednesday, September 23rd, at noon. I went along with it. It was an arbitrary deadline, but it gave us something to work with, and it gave the mayor's office 2 days to get their act together. "We'll hold off until we hear from you," I said. "But it has to be by Wednesday at noon. We'd love to make this announcement with you." The mayor nodded collegially, as if he were down with that. "But Wednesday might be tough," he said, suddenly reversing course. "I'm going to be in D.C. on Wednesday to meet the new Pope." "Uh-huh." I looked over at Andy and Senator Ananick, then across the table at Jenny. "Did he really just say he was meeting the Pope?" "This couldn't be more urgent," I went on, ignoring his bizarre non sequitur. "We need to get moving and declare a health advisory as soon as possible so we can get some proper action by the feds and the state. Every day counts. That's why we need to hear by Wednesday." Henderson grimaced, then looked away. "This could be a win-win," I said, trying not to lose it. "We could stand together and make the announcement." "Okay," the mayor said. "Okay, what?" "We'd like to hear from you within 2 days, by Wednesday," I said again, in case he didn't catch it the first few times. "After that, we will share my research publicly." "Okay," the mayor said again, nodding and beginning to rise. We all stood, said our goodbyes, and dispersed as quickly as we'd arrived. We were busy people with busy careers and lives. Some of us were focused on the kids in Flint. Some of us were looking forward to meeting the new pope. Was he planning to bring back some holy water? Texts began flying as soon as we left the building. Senator Ananick and Andy and Kirk believed the meeting had gone as badly as could be imagined. They were extremely disappointed. Mayor Walling was clearly of no use, we decided, and we had to assume he wouldn't be with us. We decided to plan a press conference for Thursday, September 24th, without him. We still hoped he'd join us, but had to start working around him. There was no reason to vilify him, we agreed, or turn him into the enemy. He had no power, being mayor in name only. The truth was that the citizens of Flint didn't have a democratically elected leader. They had a figurehead. Over the course of the day and night, Andy called me repeatedly, sometimes conferencing everybody in to coordinate a plan. He was a tall, relatively young guy and a political strategist to his bones. Always two steps ahead, always aware of political implications, and inordinately good at swearing. A know-it-all, he loved telling us all, including his boss, Senator Ananick, what to do. We each had a role to play. Senator Ananick was to work the legislative end. Kirk was to deal with the local media, now already circling the story after the Greater Flint Health Coalition resolution, and work with Dr. Reynolds to bring medical and health professionals on board. I was to finalize my study and presentation while continuing to pester the state for a data set for all of Genesee County. My tendency, when things don't go well, is to revisit my own work and see how it could be better. Was my presentation good enough, compelling enough? I also wondered about the decision to see the mayor in the first place. Perhaps I had been optimistic to assume he could be counted on to do the right thing. Maybe he and Henderson and Croft were all totally powerless, and we should have gone directly to the governor. I wondered if the meeting might have gone differently. The rest of the day was a blur of emotion, adrenaline, texts, calls, and more meetings. When I wasn't strategizing with Andy and Kirk, I still had thousands of resident applications to sift, and the rest of my Hurley responsibilities. And I was recounting the latest events to Melanie and Elin. Elin was still on the case, digging into the water treatment and corrosion weeds with Mark Edwards, and what they guessed was happening at MDEQ. In the time since she and I met Mark at lunch, he and his Flint Water Study team had been continuing to work the system just as hard as we were. Mark was emailing every possible agency and government office that dealt with the Flint water or public health. He had written the mayor, the county health department, a number of people at MDEQ, and the governor's office. Mark was already sending in Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests to obtain state and EPA email records, looking for answers. He had learned from his experience in D.C. to keep pushing the authorities consistently and firmly, and a FOIA request was the perfect way to exert pressure. He informed each agency that a request had been made, which alone might prompt them into proper action. But then, it could have another effect, too. Fear and more stalling. Rarely did the agencies turn their requests around in the time required by law. In the clinic parking lot that evening, before going home, I called Mark to tell him about the meeting with the mayor. I was still angry and pinned the blame on MDEQ and the governor's office, calling them Republican bastards who put dollars above poor kids. This was followed by a long silence. "I'm a conservative Republican," Mark said. "What?" There's no way to describe the internal chaos that ensued. My mind was spinning and reeling. Mark Edwards is a Republican? Making assumptions and leaning on stereotypes, I had mentally sized him up as a lefty activist, perhaps with a libertarian streak. If I saw myself as committed to public health and protecting kids, Mark was probably even more so. He had devoted his career to crusading against negligence and dishonesty. He believed if you weren't on the right side of a public health crisis, you were a bystander to a crime. And he wore baby animal ties. I assumed this meant he was, well, I didn't know, but whatever it was, he couldn't be a conservative Republican. This news was taking a while to sink in. I knew Republicans, and I'd grown up with Republicans, and I knew that progressives didn't have a monopoly on integrity or caring about people. At the same time, in the years I'd been working in Flint as a pediatrician, I hadn't encountered many crusaders who weren't lefties like me. But did it matter? On one hand, it did. Republicans had starved the government and made the decisions that resulted in the water switch. And the outcome only confirmed their suspicion that all government was bad. But on the other hand, what mattered wasn't politics or political philosophy. It was Flint kids. That was the ground I was willing to stand on with anybody. And it was a good piece of ground to occupy. Anyone who wasn't on it was on the wrong side, regardless of political affiliation. For Mark's part, I wondered if his politics made his iconoclastic activism easier, or at least less of an anguished struggle. I was a true believer when it came to government. I had faith in its ability to protect rights, promote equality, and mitigate historic injustice. So much of my life and advocacy rested on that. But what had happened in Flint and what was happening with the state was seriously eroding that faith. Tuesday, September 22nd came. No word from the city, nothing from the mayor's office. Every minute felt like an hour. I did my work at Hurley and tried to stay attentive and available at home, but I was a walking zombie. I hadn't eaten a true meal or anything beyond occasional bites and nibbles for weeks. I was mainlining caffeine, drinking oceans of coffee. I was wired. Once again, I found myself in an antiseptic boardroom, this time to give my presentation to Pete Levine's County Medical Society group. A dozen doctors sat around the table, along with a few Hurley residents I had brought with me from community pediatrics, including Allison. As soon as I began talking, though, one of the group's members, an older physician, confronted me. Without a sense of what she sounded like, she complained that Flint residents didn't pay their water bills and predicted this water thing would just encourage more of that, which would cause the doctor's own already high water bills to rise even more. My mouth agape, I pretended she hadn't said that. How could she say something like that? But Dr. Reynolds wasn't so forgiving. He got on her for her remarks, while Pete Levine masterfully kept things moving with adept political and diplomatic skills. Soon they were all wrapped and on board. It didn't take anything but facts and science to convince a group of doctors. By the time I was finished, the doctors had passed a resolution pledging their support. Relieved and excited, I was starting to feel the wind at my back, encouraging me. The state and city were still stonewalling, but with my data in hand, we were building a movement of doctors. Andy Levitt was eager to release my study in advance of the press conference. As usual, he had a strategy, and he was sure it was the right one. He wanted to put heat on the mayor, the health departments, and the governor. I pushed back. We had told the mayor he had until Wednesday at noon, and we had to stick to that promise. But Andy doubted me, probably figuring I knew next to nothing about political maneuvering. I would like to scream the results from every rooftop, I texted him. Sometimes you don't have to maneuver. You just have to be honest, direct, and persistent. Assuming the mayor would not respond, Andy then decided to reach out to the Washington Post. He was sure it would become a national story. The rest of us were not convinced. The Post had been late to the DC crisis, but had made up for it with great coverage later on. If there was a major newspaper that would intuitively get the importance of a lead in water story, it would be them. There were Post reporters who already knew about corrosive water and lead leaching out of old service pipes. Andy's plan was to give the Post a heads up on the Flint story and embargo my study until immediately after the press conference. This sounded great to me. A national newspaper would be difficult for the state to discredit, and it would hit the governor's office harder. While I waited to hear back from Andy, I got an email from Mark Edwards saying that if the mayor's office didn't come along, it had been decided that I'd share my results with Ron Fonger at the Flint Journal. It had been decided? This caught me off guard. Why was Mark telling me this and not Andy? and what had happened to the post? And why was Mark involved and knew about a decision before I did? My lack of food and sleep was probably a factor, or the recent discovery that Mark was a Republican. But I was suddenly paranoid and doubting his motives. What if he has a secret agenda? What if he's just trying to get back at government because of DC? I called Andy right away. Can you please confirm that we're going with Ron Fonger? Yeah, he said. Mark contacted a reporter he knows at the Post who worked on the DC crisis. Word came back that the paper is busy this week with the Hillary email story. They said no. Besides, Mark really thinks Ron is great and deserves it. Fonger had been on the water story from the beginning. And you think that's the best approach? I do. Okay, I said, exhaling. Just needed to check. Before bed, Kirk texted us all to report that Mayor Walling had called him at home, wanting to talk. The mayor had been ruminating and was full of justifications. Everybody knows they're supposed to flush the water, he said. Kirk objected and pressured him to stand with us, but the mayor felt it was unnecessary. Wednesday, September 23rd arrived, the day of the mayor's deadline. I took my mom to the hospital for eye surgery. I brought my laptop and phone and had both going in the waiting room while she was in surgery and then in recovery. Her doctor came out and, realizing that I was a doctor too, switched into doctor speak and shared how everything had gone. The whole thing had lasted just a couple of hours. I worked on my presentation and was in constant contact with Mark, my brother, who wanted to know first how Bibi was doing and second, what was going on in Flint. It seemed like a very long time ago that we talked things out while doing the jigsaw puzzle, but it had only been a few days. My mom was wearing eye patches and was supposed to rest. I took her photo, it was a little grisly, and texted it to my brother. Proof that she was out of surgery. Then I got her into her house and into bed. I closed the curtains and dimmed the lights. Mona, tell me what's going on.
What do you mean, Mama?
You know what I mean. Everything is good. I'm helping with a situation, something the state isn't doing but should.
Like what?
Like it's the kind of thing you taught me to do. Something you would do if you had a chance. My patients, my kids. It's like they were in an accident. A lot of them were. And it wasn't their fault. She became quiet. I think she knew I wasn't going to say anything more than that. She had a knack for leaving me alone and giving me space when I needed it. And I knew she would ask Mark, and he would explain it better than I could. I checked my phone. It was noon. Nothing. The deadline had passed. Chapter 18. Ab. To make sure Mayor Walling knew the deadline had passed, somebody in Senator Ananick's press office called him to double-check. Sure enough, we were told that there would be no cooperation from the mayor's office, so we moved ahead without him. The Hurley press people met me in my office and began working on an advisory to the media, announcing a press conference at the hospital the next day. There was almost no information in the release, or as little as possible. But behind the scenes, we were working every angle to make sure we had built a coalition of support. Andy was still quarterbacking, while Kirk leaned on his contacts in the professional health and medical worlds, preparing them to stand behind me. Jordan Dickerson, our congressman's aide, was away from Representative Kildee's office, but still in the loop. He planned to issue a statement as soon as the story broke. And Senator Ananick's press office was working with Ron Fonger at the Flint Journal, teeing him up to break the story. Fonger called, and we made a plan to meet at the Hurley Clinic in the morning so I could explain my study to him and answer any questions. Mark Edwards gave his EPA buddies, especially Miguel del Toro, a heads up and told his trusted media contacts that my team had been able to produce the final piece of the puzzle that was missing in the DC crisis. Blood data. Proof of impact. This is a game changer, Mark kept saying. He predicted that the state would not be able to continue stalling. He told Leanne Walters and other citizen scientists
and Flint activists about the press conference and urged them to attend. After being ignored for so long, they had doubts that the medical community was actually going to do anything. Mark assured